that would read for the day, but it's not quite. There is another talk at 6 o'clock, 6 to 7, by Jones Foley, on black hole evaporation and information. That is not exactly necessarily part of the workshop, but it's definitely related, so you're very welcome to attend.
Where is it?
Right here. So if the participants of the workshop want to take off after 6 o'clock for dinner, that's the regular schedule of the workshop, but some of us will stick around for that talk, and we plan to meet at 7:15 around here, and then go for lunch together, so if anybody wants to join us. Go out for dinner, then we'll meet here at 7:15. Right, so...
Okay, well, I understand that this is informal, so the intention here is very informal. This proceeded from an exchange that we had with Hakeem and Justin, in which I said probably foolishly, definitely foolishly, from my second point of view, these are important questions. So I read this, which is the question that the meeting addresses, and thought that those of us who see quantum space-time and quantum gravity from a background-independent or non-perturbative perspective, have perhaps something to say about this. And and I said, maybe I can have 5 minutes to say something. And now we have 90 minutes. And so, since I certainly don't have 90 minutes to say, I thought it would be good to have several different perspectives. So these are going to be four quite different perspectives about these questions from the point of view of a background independent point of view. By myself, by Thomas Tiemann, by Totini Marcopulo, and by Olaf Dreyer, in that order. The common idea is that maybe the mystery of what to do about quantum field theory, ultraviolet cutoffs, creation of modes, and so forth, about those mysteries which arise, first of all, in a semi-classical perspective, where the matter degrees of freedom of quantum and the space-time is classical, arise differently in a perspective in which the space-time is also totally quantum mechanical. Now, having said that, I'm aware of two things. One of them is that several of the experts are in the audience, and since that's such an obvious thought, they must have an obvious rejoinder to it, and will undoubtedly hear it. In my little presentation, I'm going to do two things. I'm going to first talk about really how this question is addressed from the point of view of loop quantum gravity, just because I happen to know something about it, but I think that from other research programs which are background independent, for example, dynamical triangulations, the same comments would be made. I'm going to take advantage of your attention and kindness to very briefly talk about some very new work in progress having to do with the notion of disordered locality, and this is work with Fotini and Chandra Prescott Weinstein, who is here. And we want to emphasize that this is work in progress, and it scares us. So if it bothers you, you should know that it scares us, which is why we've been slowly thinking all of this over. Okay, so that's my two points of agenda. Okay, now, the first thing is, and the two things are not that closely related, but look, loop quantum gravity may be right or may be wrong, but it proceeds from three simple principles, and I would suggest that to the extent that those principles are right, there are results that do address the question of the meeting. So those principles are, first of all, that all forces are gauge forces, so that we have to think about matter fields like fermion, perhaps, and gauge fields and nothing else. And second, the old idea, which goes back, you know, is maybe the key idea in theoretical physics, the second half of the 20th century, that there's an equivalence between a quantum gauge field and the dynamics of some extended object, since it's expressed different ways from different points of view in different research programs. The idea that loop quantum gravity came from was work by Colin Kaufman and McDonald and many other people thinking about QCD, that the observables, the quantum observables of a gauge theory are not local and are actually described in terms of Wilson loops and the dynamics of Wilson loops. And the third principle is that we're dealing with the dynamics, therefore, of Wilson loops on a manifold which has diffeomorphism invariance and which has no metric and no other classical background structure. It does have a manifold structure. It is a three-dimensional manifold differentially and topologically, but it has no other structure. And the basic idea is that the gravitational field is described as a gauge theory. The space-time connection is the gauge field. And the space-time metric information is embedded in the electric field. And I work here, so I should know where the pointer is. In the electric field, in such a way that the electric flux through a surface is the same thing as measuring the area of the surface. And then the key choice that's made in the quantization is to choose to quantize the algebra of observables of the flux of electric field through surfaces and the Wilson loops. Okay. Now, a lot of results follow from that. One way to state the situation recently, because of work of Thomas and colleagues, is that there is a uniqueness theorem that there is a unique representation of that algebra on a manifold of dimension 2 or greater in which the Hilbert space carries a unitary representation of the diffeomorphism group of the manifold. And so we take advantage of that by working within that representation. And that is the foundation of this set of approaches, which is called loop quantum gravity. And from that, everything else follows. And since there is this uniqueness theorem, I think one can say that these are assumptions that we want to take seriously these principles, and we want to take seriously making quantization in terms of that algebra. After that, a number of things follow, including discreteness of the quantum geometry, the discreteness of the volume operator, and so forth. And I think I skip because here's the main points from the point of view of the issue of this workshop. First, that in this class of theories, if you make the choices that are made, diffeomorphism invariance plus quantum theory leads to discreteness of quantum geometry and an ultraviolet cutoff, all described in a very conventional separable Hilbert space for both the matter and the gravitational degrees of freedom. The second point, the volume of space is represented by an operator which is positive definite and has a discrete spectrum. And therefore, there are sectors of the Hilbert space for each possible volume of space. And third, the dynamics, whether discussed in a Hamiltonian framework or in a path integral framework, gives you amplitudes for transitions between states with different volumes. So this is perhaps an approach to the problems raised by the workshop. That is, there's no issue with, as the universe grows, there are more degrees of freedom. Of course, if the universe grows, there are more degrees of freedom, because one is in different sectors of Hilbert space. But if one has successfully quantized the gravitational field and the matter together, or if the matter arises out of the quantization of the gravitational field, which some of us think in recent work, Then the degrees of freedom of the matter are created as the degrees of freedom of the geometry in which they live are created. So that's the moral. Okay. Now I'm going to switch gears. Because, and it's interesting, it's nice that Ted is here, because there's an issue with this whole picture that Ted raised back at the very beginning, which then I think disappeared, and then Fotini began to raise it again. And this is the issue of non-locality. And one way to put it is the following, that there are two kinds of locality in such a theory. First of all, the Hilbert space, I didn't say this, but I assume that it's known, and if it's not known, the states of quantum geometry which form a basis are graphs embedded in the topological free space, or the diffeomorphic free space up to diffeomorphism. And there is locality in the graph. This node is connected to this node, and there may be a matter degree of freedom here and a matter degree of freedom here, which would then be coupled locally in that state. Okay. But there is also the hope and expectation and some results that suggest that classical geometry emerges from suitable states, semi-classical states, in the Hilbert space, which has a basis of these graphs. And if that happens, there will be a notion of a metric which emerges semi-classically, and there will be a notion of locality in the metric. And the issue is, why in the world would you expect those two notions of locality to coincide? It's not built into the dynamics of the theory that they coincide. Okay? And if they don't coincide, then fundamental interactions which are local fundamentally at the Planck scale might look non-local in terms of some emergent classical geometry description. Okay. And that's the issue. Ted, I don't know if you remember, I remember arguing, well, you said it in different terms. Okay. But certainly, Fotini has been raising this for several years.
Are these lines represent what lead between the points?
These is an edge of a graph in a spin network.
The edges are what?
The edges represent states of quantized electric flux. Okay. Now, this issue could happen two ways. It could happen because the semi-classical state is a superposition of many graphs, which each have a different notation, a notion of microlocality. And it could also happen because there could be a graph which looked almost local, that it looked something like a lattice. Imagine this going on for many, many Planck edges. And then one just added an edge to the graph connecting two things that are far away. Okay? Now, and what's the consequence of that? So this is a worry. And this work that we've been doing has been motivated by this worry. And the sense is that this will either kill the theory, that is, kill all the kind of theories that I've been describing, or it's an opportunity from which physics comes. And the reason why, there's a third possibility, which is that the dynamics solves the problem in the fundamental dynamics, but we don't see any evidence for that. And I'll discuss why briefly.
Yeah. Is it fair to say that that's the problem of keeping the number of dimensions stable?
Well, yes, if you like, although you may be thinking in a framework where the number of dimensions is fixed because you have a diffeomorphic structure, a diffeomorphic to begin with, and so the number of dimensions is fixed. Even if that's true, then this is an issue. Okay. And one way to argue it is, supposing you have a nice, something that you think of as a semi-classical state, where by hook or by crook the two notions of locality coincide, that is, the microscopic state looks like something like a lattice in which you only have connections between nodes that are close in the metric that somehow represents some average properties of it. Okay. Well, then let's think about ways to disorder this by adding a link randomly. Okay, if there are n Planck volumes, roughly speaking, there's a Planck volume per node, then they're going to be on the order of n times the number of dimensions, way to disorder it, that don't affect the notion that only local edges in the semi-classical metric get connected. But there will be n squared ways to disorder it in ways that disorder the notion of locality. So unless the dynamics can suppress that, and there's a huge entropy factor, then there is an issue with disordered locality. Okay. So we think there is a worry. And there are different approaches to addressing this worry. What I'm going to be talking about is only the most naive one. Okay. So we talk about this as dislocations or disordering of locality. Now, it turns out that in the statistical mechanics world, there's been a lot of study of the same kind of problem. The problem is, what is the physics? Supposing that you have an ordinary lattice spin system or lattice quantum field theory, and you add a small number of edges that connect faraway nodes, disordering the notion of locality. What does that do to the statistical physics of your system? And it turns out that that's a question which is of interest to statistical mechanics, and such systems are called small world networks. And there's a lot of study of physics on small world networks, which I'm going to exploit in a moment. Okay? Now, various people here have been doing various things with this. Hal Finkel, who was a student here last summer, studied stochastic evolution of graphs according to rules like are used in loop quantum gravity, and showed that this kind of situation is a generic outcome of starting with small random graphs and then evolving by local rules. So you might think, because the evolution moves are local, and my introduction was so brief I didn't say that, so let me just draw a typical evolution move, which is an exchange move like this, or an expansion move like this. You might think that because those moves are local, if you start, no matter what you start with, if you do enough local moves, you get a local graph, but the answer is you don't. And I'll be explaining why in a second. Yudin Wan studied here, and other people elsewhere have done studies of Ising models and other spin systems to understand what happens to the statistical mechanics. And there's a lot of interesting things to discuss here, which, since this is an informal, very brief presentation, I won't tell you about it in case somebody asks. But it turns out to be not as easy. If you ask a physical question, could you tell the difference between physics on a lattice that you're familiar with and physics on a slightly locality disordered graph, the answer is it's harder than you think. And I can embellish on that if people want me to. So here is a simple model of how this might address some cosmological problems. Okay. And I'm suppressing details and going quickly, and I'm happy to answer questions. We think we could answer a few questions about this, and undoubtedly you can ask lots of questions we can't answer. So here's the model. We start with the Friedman-Robertson-Walker space-time. I couldn't get the thing to... Oh, there it goes. Okay. And how we're going to represent the notion of disordered locality is the following way. We're going to pick n points within a co-moving volume, okay, and n pairs of points, and we're going to say those pairs of points are identified, which we're going to take to mean, microscopically, there is an edge going from the node in the region of one point to a node in the region of the other point. And we're going to choose them randomly. And I'll tell you what that means in a second. Is it the yellow button? Okay. So to start with, we have a function p, x, and y are points of space, or space-time, depending on how we're doing it. A is the scale factor, because we're in Friedman-Robertson-Walker. It's the probability that there's such a non-local connection between a point in some unit volume around x and a unit volume around y. Okay. We're going to assume a scale invariant distribution. There's some evidence, not very good evidence, but evidence from Hal Finkel's studies and other studies, that, and I'll give you one hand-waving argument towards it, that these distributions can evolve to scale invariant. And scale invariant means that this distribution is a function only of 1 over the volume squared times some function of the scale factor. And the volume is, of course, the scale factor cubed. Okay. So that there's an equal random probability that any 2 points within the Hubble volume are connected in this way.
Sorry, can I ask you, in your understanding, are these nodes supposed to be created before, after, or during inflation?
We're going to discuss at all times, but that's a good question that we haven't thought enough about. I'm going to be discussing post-inflation.
Because maybe you would think they would get diamond.
I'm going to address that just in a second. Okay. So, the total number of non-local links within a co-moving volume represented by sigma is the double integral of that over space, and I'm going to be interested in that. Okay, now the statistical mechanics people have found that for the purposes of computing thermodynamic quantities, there's an interesting approximation in which rather than saying that there's a small probability that any 2 nodes or points are connected, you say that all points are connected with a very small bond strength or interaction given by the probability for 2 points to be interacted over the volume squared. So basically, you're replacing a random distribution of these non-local links with saying every 2 nodes are connected with a very small interaction. And there is evidence that in 3 dimensions and above, this is a good approximation to the thermodynamics and statistical mechanics studies.
You said that from the beginning that these links were the electric flux. So how does this tie in with the electric flux?
But this is the electric flux of the gravitational field.
Yeah.
So these are long stretched links of the electric flux of the gravitational field. Now, the action, we use then an effective action, which is the usual one, plus a non-local one. And I'm just going to skip a lot of details. The important thing is that the non-local interaction is a double integral over space-time. Okay. We assume that there's some field degree of freedom of interest that we call sigma that could be a gravitational degree of freedom and could be a matter degree of freedom. And they're coupled between any 2 points with probability p. Okay. And we're also going to make the drastic assumption, okay, because these could be coupled in space-time or there could be some preferred slice in space. And because of simplicity, and maybe because we're not entirely antithetical to the idea that there really is a preferred frame of reference fundamentally in quantum gravity, the game we're going to show you is it's been coupled in space, so there's some preferred cosmological time slicing. We're within Friedman, Robertson, Walker, after all. Now, therefore, the only quantity of interest is the number of these non-local links in a co-moving volume as a function of the scale factor. And it turns out that there are processes in which under these local moves, they multiply. If you have 1, it becomes 2, and processes whereby if you have 2, they become 1. And to go very quickly through it, the processes where 1 become 2 look like that. And the processes where 2 become 1 are the reverse. And the first is proportional to n. The probability is proportional to n over v. The second, n squared over v cubed. So there is an equilibrium between creating and destroying these non-local connections when the number of them scales like the volume squared of the co-moving factor. So we assume that somehow that equilibrium has been established. Okay? Then here's a bunch of equations, but here's the physical picture. The physical picture is that consider any degree of freedom, okay, say some matter field. Okay. Then that matter field at a point is connected with the same strength in this approximation to the matter field at every other point. Therefore, it's coupled to its average volume. To its average value. Therefore, the mean field approximation is exact. Therefore, there's an effective potential which goes like the average value squared, which is in the energetics of the system. And one can compute what the mass is, and the mass is equal to the Planck length times the density of non-local connections, which again, we just said is a function of the scale factor. So that's the key, or that's a first result. And because I only have a few minutes, I'm going through this quickly. One can estimate what's the density of these non-local connections required to get up to the present observed dark energy. And the answer depends on whether we're talking about coupling gravitational degrees of freedom or matter degrees of freedom, because there's a difference in a factor of the Planck length squared for the gravitational coupling. If in the gravitational case, one gets a density of non-local connections in Planck units of 10 to the minus 120, which is macroscopic, it's something like one per every mountain, roughly. So if you want to see something, I forget how many centimeters cubed that is. Okay. If it's a matter degree of freedom, one gets that there is one mouth of these non-local couplings per cubic Fermi. And that sounds like a lot, but it's not easy to communicate across them. So a challenge that we've set ourselves and been unable, maybe somebody here can do it, is supposing that there is a high density of non-local connections, but still low enough that you're very unlikely that a non-local, one end of a non-local connection in this room connects to somewhere else in this room. So if there is one in a little volume, it's equally likely to go anywhere else in the universe. And assume that the cross-section for a matter quanta to jump across it goes like the energy squared times Newton's constant, which is, that is, that the cross-section is the Planck length squared. So the rate goes like the energy cubed times Newton's constant. Okay. Can you find an observation or an experiment that could kill this hypothesis? We haven't been able to. Okay. I think I should come to a stop and let Thomas speak. I'll just mention another pretty obvious idea that works out, which is if there's a scale invariant distribution of non-local connections, so that points here are in some large enough region here, you'll find a point which is randomly connected to points elsewhere. And if you have a thermal distribution of radiation, then you're going to get a correction to the two-point function for the thermal fluctuations of that radiation. And if the distribution of non-local connections is scale invariant, then the effect that you get on the power spectrum is also scale invariant, which means it goes like 1 over k cubed. There's a little bit of math you have to go through to get there. It does get there. So there's at least a possibility, and we don't want to make any real claim yet, but there's at least a possibility that these non-local connections could both explain the dark energy and explain the scale invariant spectrum of radiation seen. A third thing, which is sort of obvious, but I'll say it, is that if the universe is full of these non-local connections, and if the probability to jump across them goes, or the rate goes like Newton's constant times the energy cube, then at early times there'll be a lot of jumping when the temperature is high, and therefore there's no horizon problem. Okay, so that's our speculative remarks, and thank you very much. And I don't know if you want any discussion. Thomas's presentation.
One question, while we're
sure.
Did you say that so the number of your links grows as the volume squared?
Yes.
So the energy density grows as the energy?
Yes.
So it doesn't really, today, if you fix the energy density today to be the dark energy, it's time dependent,
yes.
Not constant.
It's time dependent.
It's rising quickly.
It's rising quickly, and the future of the universe is to dissipate in a sea of non-locality, some hundreds, billions of years hence. We came from non-locality and we will go back to non-locality.
And how long are these connections?
So the assumption is randomly distributed.
But a mean name? A lifetime?
No, Hubble scale.
Infrared?
Yes.
Well, why don't they break up?
Because they can only, I described for you, they evolve by interactions which are local in the microscopic dynamics, and they cannot just break
up. Well, if you have matter, and the matter is coupled to the electric field, then you can create pairs, and you can break
I understand what you're saying, and I don't want to take Thomas's time, we could discuss that, but that will not disappear these non-local connections. I can talk to you later about what that will do.
Okay.
Thomas, I'm supposed to hit the right button here, right? Full screen view.
Good.
Yeah. I want to thank you for inviting me for this session. So my talk will be almost completely classical. So it has actually nothing to do with quantum gravity, right? Any quantum gravity theory. Quantum gravity theory at all. Except for the last slide, actually. Okay?
Yes.
Okay. So the thing that I'm addressing here is sometimes called the problem of time. This is a puzzle that has bothered me since I was studying Ward's book, on the beautiful book by Bob Ward on general relativity. So I'm going to recall that problem and I'm trying in a cosmological setting. Then I'll tell you about a solution which has been around for about 10 years, but I think it hasn't been emphasized enough, at least I think so. And then I will address some future work, and there I will actually think about quantum issues. So let me first describe the problem. The problem is the following. So general relativity is a gauge theory, like Young-Mills theory, like Maxwell theory. Just the diffeomorphism group is, so the gauge group is a diffeomorphism group. And there are various ways to describe this. One is by canonical analysis. So what you're doing when you canonically formulate general relativity, you assume that the space-time manifold is a direct product of real line and some spatial manifold, S. And what you then see is, when you turn the crank, that you can describe the theory in terms of a canonical pair, namely a free metric, and the conjugate momentum. I think that everybody has seen this before. These are just the usual ADN variables. And then the space space is subject to constraints. The first set of constraints are so-called spatial diffeomorphism constraints. I will say why they are called like this in a minute. So this is the analytic expression for this thing. Nabla is just a covariant derivative which is compatible with Q. And then there's the more awful Hamiltonian constraint. By the way, U is a three-dimensional, I mean, it's a vector field on S, and it's a three-dimensional manifold S. And N is another test field, which is sometimes called the lattice function. So these are two test fields. So we have an infinite number of constraints. So for each test field, we get a different constraint. And they are called constraints because these functions have to vanish. And also this function has to vanish. And this is the analytic expression for this constraint. So I will not make any use of this analytic expression, just in case you have seen this before. These are just familiar Hamiltonian and spatial diffeomorphism constraints. So why are they called like this? Because of the following fact. So if you take this linear combination of the test fields, so n is our lattice function again, and this little n here is a normal vector field, the normal to the hypersurfaces which foliate in the spacetime, and x is an embedding variable which embeds the three-dimensional spaces into your four-dimensional spacetime. Then you discover that the following holds. So we take
this linear combination of constraints, and you compute the Poisson brackets between these constraints, then you get a representation of the diffeomorphism algebra of the space-time manifold. So that's why I was calling the spatial diffeomorphism constraint as I did, because in particular, if you set n equal to 0, then you get the algebra of spatial diffeomorphisms. And if you set n equal to 0, if you set u equal to 0, then you get something like the diffeomorphism subgroup of normal diffeomorphisms. And we know that the theory derives from a diffeomorphism grand Lagrangian, so we have diffeomorphisms as a gauge group sitting there. So the constraints that we have really generate gauge transformations. That's the first lesson. And in physics, everything has to be gauge invariant. Everything that is observable has to be gauge invariant. So in any function that we might be interested in, which should describe the physical quantity f, has to commute, Poisson commute with these constraints. In particular, what people sometimes call the gauge, the equations of motion, sometimes, which are just nothing else than v q by dt given by the Poisson bracket between the constraints and q at d and p at d, are not really equations of motion, they're gauge transformations. They're not describing the physical evolution of observable objects. They are describing reparameterizations of unphysical objects or unobservables. And this is where we get to the puzzle. Because if we specialize general into a cosmological context, then we really have the same form. We have forming forms. So my question can be phrased as this: why is it that the Friedmann Robertson Walker equations describe the observed cosmic evolution? This is the Hamiltonian constraint in the cosmological setting for a Friedmann Robertson Walker situation with k equal to 0. So p is the conjugate momentum to the scale factor. Lambda is the cosmological constant. Rho m is matter density. What you do now, you take this Hamiltonian constraint. The spatial diffeomorphic constraint is not there because this system is so simple that it's identity satisfied. So what you do now is to solve the equation a dot for p, resubstitute into this, and then take the second time derivative. So what you get is the second set of FRW equations. So we see that these equations describe, on one hand, a constraint. On the other hand, it describes the gauge transformations of unobservable objects. In other words, if A, for example, the scale factor would be an observable object, then it would have to be commuting with the constraint. But it doesn't, otherwise this equation would be void. So what's going on? And this is precisely the problem. In other words, we observe the evolution of the universe, or the expansion of the universe, for example, by redshift experiments. So A dot can be 0. On the other hand, A is not related, at least not in this mathematical language, to anything that is observed. So that's very strange. And I now want to discuss a possible solution. The solution is, or the suggestion is, the physical time evolution is driven by actually an unobservable meta component, which is sometimes referred to. You can find several different names for this. It's sometimes called the mechanism of deparameterization, or the notion of a physical block, and so on. So that the meta component, which I'm adding here to the rest of the meta component. Matter is the Fanton field because, for a reason that I will explain in a second, this is a DBI action, the Dirac-Bond infeld action. And for the phantom field, which are called phi. And this is the most complicated slide in my talk, so let me do it quickly. If I denote by capital Q the determinant of the free metric, and this quadratic combination is the dA is not the total diffeomorphism constraint, it's just the diffeomorphism constraint related to ordinary matter and to the geometry. So it doesn't take into account the contribution by the phantom field itself. While this is the total Hamiltonian constraint, which one can reformulate in this form, where phi is the momentum conjugate to this phantom field, then we discover that this quantity H takes the following form. So it's a positive expression.
So did you say what are you plus, minus, 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 or the opposite?
So this is for the phantom field because I'm taking the minus plus plus plus. So this it goes with the wrong kinetic term. So kinetic term goes with the wrong sign of the reaction. That's why it's called a phantom. And now we construct the following objects. First of all, we construct an object, capital H, which we call a physical Hamiltonian, which is just the time and the spatial integral over this densities here, which should be constructed. So notice, first of all, that H is not the Hamiltonian constraint. The Hamiltonian constraint is phi plus H, and this is the spatial integral, so that's the difference. So in particular, H is not constrained to bench. This thing is constrained to bench. The physical time evolution of observable objects can be now given by the following formula. So first of all, this formula, given any functional phase space, defines a one-parameter family of observables. So these are things which really commute with C total. And the time evolution of these objects is given by this formula. So it's driven really by this Hamiltonian. So what people call this deparametrization, because we have this entangled defining the physical evolution from the gauge transformation. And now let me apply this framework to cosmology, in particular again to our Friedman, Robertson, Walker case. And in this case, everything is spatially homogeneous. So in particular, we find that phi, the momentum conjugate to the scale factor, turns out to be a constant of the motion, motion in the sense of gauge transformation. So it's an observable object already. So it takes some particular value, E, which is actually the energy of the universe. And with this quantity, so remember that there was this parameter S in front of the phantom action. This parameter goes into this quantity X, which is an observable quantity. E is the energy, so it's observable. S is just the parameter in the action, and O, A of tau, is the observable quantity associated with the scale factor. So that's a physical time. Physical time is denoted by tau. Physical time, dependent parameters. And now we can compute the equations of motion with respect to the physical Hamiltonian. The first set of Friedman, Robertson, Walker equations results in this quantity. So it takes the standard form, except that there's a correction term, which is labeled by this x parameter. And the second one results by the standard technique by just taking the second time derivative of the first equation. It results in this quantity, where again you get the usual stuff up to corrections which go like 1 over x. So, what does this mean? It means, at least for this particular model, or for this particular method component, that if you want to express time evolution in terms of physical quantities and the physical Hamiltonian, that there are corrections to the Friedmann-Robertson-Walker space time equations. And they are labeled by this parameter x, which is already also time dependent. So let's all look at this quantity x. When the universe is very young, then A, or the observer associated to it, will be very small. So x will be very large, and 1 over x will be very small. So we don't see any difference for early times. And even for later times, you can tune this parameter s in such a way that x stays small. Maybe until today, maybe until 30 billion years or something, but unavoidably at some point, this quantity will become large. And if you study the equations of motion that are derived from these equations for, let's say, usual baryonic matter at late times, then you discover that this set of equations unavoidably leads to recollapse in the universe for purely classical grounds. There's no quantum gravity here at all. So that finishes the classic part. Now let's actually come to the conclusions and some outlook.
So when will this collapse occur?
Well, it depends on several things. So there's this parameter in your quantum action.
Suppose it is zero.
Well, then I don't have a phantom action, and the whole thing breaks down.
But is your message it is needed to have a phantom, or it's convenient?
Well,
it is the nature. I mean,
it's
a mathematical trick to get those equations in those form, or it's a physical.
No. There was the guiding physical principle. Thank you for asking this question, because I forgot to mention it. The guiding physical principle was to find an action which, via this mechanism of deparameterization, leads to a physical Hamiltonian, which is close to the standard model Hamiltonian. When space is
really close to what?
The standard model Hamiltonian. So, at least when space is close to flat, in flat regions.
You say that the square root, etc., of the graph phi squared is a standard model Hamiltonian?
Okay, so let's look at this equation. So C is everything except for the phantom field. So it's the Hamilton constraint associated with everything except for the phantom. So in flat case, it reduces to the matter density of matter, of, let's say, standard matter. When the phantom is spatially homogeneous, which is a necessary criterion for it to be a good synchronized block, then it turns out that B is equal to zero. And when S is very small, then this quantity reduces to C, which is just what we want. And if you look in the space of Lagrangians, which have this effect that H, the Hamiltonian, reduces to the Hamiltonian of standard model, then you discover that this is actually the only solution. Putting it.
So what do you want to be phantom? If you did the same trick with standard dots,
mm-hmm.
Then you also solve the problem of time?
You solve the problem of time, but you get a Hamiltonian which goes like a square root of the standard matter Hamiltonian. So this is not what I want.
Why not?
Well, we do very successfully physics at the colliders with the Hamiltonian of the standard model, not at the square root.
Why does it have to be DBI instead of some other kind of higher derivative action?
So that's I started this. So what's the most general thing that you can write down? The covariant Lagrangian, which is such that the physical Hamiltonian reduces to that of the standard model when space is close to flat.
The total action to the Einstein action of plus.
So the total, yeah, exactly. So the total action is Einstein-Hilbert plus standard matter.
So the Planck mass comes in somewhere.
Well, the Planck mass doesn't come in yet.
No, I mean, if you add the two, then the Planck mass.
Newton's constant is something,
yes.
But h-bar, there's no h-bar so far.
Yeah.
Just.
I mean, g.
Yeah, the Newton constant is somewhere there.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
So h involves the g.
S, yeah, in the right units.
You only take the big end of it.
Yes.
One over G or G? When you do it.
So now let's look at the dimensionalities. So if so one is dimensionless, correct. So this has to be dimensionless. So one S should have the same dimension as. So it's not the same dimension as this. Something else than the Newton's constant.
I'm thinking about
we can figure out the dimensionality.
No perpetual constant. Perpetual bigger or small.
But S is a free constant.
S is a free constant. It's a parameter.
Not
a field.
How would it involve the gravitational
problem? It's independent. It's independent of the gravitational problem.
It can't be because you have the two. You have the dip of gravity and you have that function.
No, the
function is between
GR action. The GR action has the Newton constant. And this one is an independent constant.
But the matter is coupled to gravity, and so
right,
the pieces of the matter.
Right, but this is
the back of gravity.
There are three pieces. There's the Einstein piece, there's the ordinary matter piece. Between them is Newton's constant, and there's this third piece, which is scaled by an independent constant. So for better or worse, he gets to choose S. So you can imagine.
I don't understand your answer to the question why it should be GR, because it can be any function of del pi squared, presumably for what we call del pi squared x, but when they do a small expansion around the x, basically a Taylor series expanded is 1 plus, you know, x over 2. And in this way, you will reproduce what you call standard model.
But this result is exact. So this equation, coming from here to here, when you solve it, why don't we just put this enormous scalar field, like just three scalar fields, this is just without a mask. You discover that this Hamiltonian goes like 1 over that Hamiltonian, or 1 over the square of that Hamiltonian. So it's very critical how you choose that action.
So you can show
it's not a conservative result, it's an exact result.
Yeah, but if you chose some other exact function that was 1 plus some correction, you could just get a different Hamiltonian.
But I want that Hamiltonian in flat case situations to reproduce the standard model Hamiltonian.
Well, what are these cases you need? This is the only one?
This is the only solution that I have thought.
Thomas, maybe you should go on.
Yeah, so I was almost done, actually. So let me come to the conclusions then. So what do we want to do with this in the future? So one issue that people are cosmology are very interested in is to do cosmological perturbation theory, and the linear perturbation theory has been developed by Buchanan and Dorn. And what people are discussing nowadays is higher orders. And there you run into troubles because there are certain issues that have to do with gauge demands, or automorphism demands that you have to take care of, and where the system of equations that we have becomes inconsistent. Now, if you do this, everything in terms of observable quantities, like in our framework, then there's nothing that can go wrong. And this is work in progress with my colleagues, which are listed here. The other thing that you can do now is the following. Remember that in cosmology we have the bug. Which point of time should we impose the state function that the vacuum should be annihilated by a given set of creation annihilation operators? That problem is gone if we use the physical Hamiltonian, which asks that the vacuum should be a minimum energy eigenstate of this Hamiltonian. So there's no debate at which time you choose the ground state. In any case, the time that you usually use in order to define ground states is not a physical time parameter, as I have emphasized in this talk. Physical states are time independent in a sense, they are gauge invariant. And I just wanted to mention that, at least in simplified calculations, so this, if you want to do this in the quantum theory, of course, we have to use the quantum theory of gravity. So I'm in favor of loop quantum gravity. I want to just mention that there are certain model calculations in loop quantum gravity which indicate that there's a resolution of the initial singularity. So thank you very much.
Thanks. I'll try to be short so that maybe Ola has a chance to speak after me as well.
We started, we're fine.
Okay. So I'm going to keep much closer to the rest of the day's discussion than the other two speakers did. So I'm considering something that Bob Brandon and Rafa considered, which is a setup where you have the assumption that fundamentally there is a cutoff, and you have one way or another locally finite regions of space-time. So there isn't a continuum at the fundamental level. And the problem appears to be that if there is such a cutoff in the degrees of freedom in the universe, then as space expands, then you should have the degrees of freedom or the modes increase, and that leads also to all sorts of problems with linearity and so on. So what I want to say is that you can actually do a whole bunch of things in that setup. And so, for example, Brandon said that it's actually pretty hard to put a quantum field theory in a causal set, which is not completely obvious to me. So there seem to be several, at least several sets that I can do that don't create any problems. So in particular, the question I'm going to be posing is this. Can you promote the above setup to quantum systems? So turn these guys into quantum systems representing your now quantum fundamental degrees of freedom, and turn your arrows, the causal relations between those, into quantum operations in a consistent way. So could you now have a setup that looks like this, where you go between, say, finite dimensional state spaces and algebras with the appropriate operations so that maybe you increase dimensionality, maybe not. So my I would be happy if I could do that so that, one, I get unitarity when I expect it, that is when information is preserved. So say that I have a causal setup like this one here, where what the arrows tell me is that all the information that has left 1 and 2 has reached 3 and 4, then I would expect that whatever operations I put on these arrows should combine to give an overall unitary evolution from the past combined Hilbert space to the future one, which is reasonable, right? You would all expect that. The other thing is that I want my assignment of quantum operations to respect the causal links. So here, if I know that I'm going from 1 to 2 and 2 to 3 and 4, there is a whole bunch of different ways that I could be doing this. And I want my quantum operations to respect what the arrows are saying. And third, I mean, I want the whole thing, obviously, to be mathematically consistent in the sense that probabilities make sense and so on. So then you do this. Yes. So what I'm talking about is basically in this paper, which is a great improvement of a previous setup of mine. And further things have been understood by these people. So I'll get to the answer. So here's how you do it. Here's how you promote a causal set to a quantum analog of it. So what I start with is a directed graph with no cycles in the usual way. So I say that if I have an arrow from x to y, I say that x is before y, or x and y are related. If I don't have an arrow, say, between these two here, then I say these are unrelated. And the way I'm moving on to a quantum version of that is that I map every element of my directed graph to a finite dimensional state space. And hence, I also have a finite dimensional algebra of operators in the state space. So I have a matrix algebra of operators for every element of my graph. Every time two elements are unrelated, I get the tensor product. And now, if I have an arrow like here from x to y, then this relation, this arrow, becomes a quantum operation. That is a completely positive map from the operators on the in to the operators on the out. Completely positive map, the definition is that it is a map going from the operators on the input space to the operators on the output space, which is linear and trace preserving and positive, as you would expect. So it maps density matrix to density matrices. But you furthermore need the condition of complete positivity, which means that if I take my system, which I would normally evolve with phi, so I would go from here to there with phi, and I join another quantum system, MK, these are the operators on the other system, such that the other guy does nothing, then the whole combined evolution should also be positive. This condition turns out to rule out certain unphysical setups that satisfy all the other conditions of positivity, trace preserving, linearity, but still do not take it from density matrices in corresponding to a physical operation. So then let me give a couple of names to some things I'm going to use. A very important thing that happens if you consider causal processes is simply this. If you have, say, this configuration where these two guys go to these two guys, then you have the notion that if you're at y, you can construct this set of elements that led to it, right? So if you run back to their proper ways of defining that, but I don't want to go into this. But basically, it's what you would get. So at y, I can go back, trace back all the arrows that hit y, and the origin points are the complete past of y, right? And the reverse is the complete future of y. This is always much easier to see the picture than you say the words. So I hope it's pretty straightforward that in this setup, these two points are the complete past of y, and these two are the complete future of x. And you're happy with that?
Isn't just y the complete future of x?
Actually, yes. Right. You're right. So somebody's away. So these two are the complete future of this, yeah. Sorry.
I have one other question. Does your general framework allow standard evolution from pure to mixed states?
Yes. So then what I want is, if I have this particular setup, these all are distinct configurations you would have, and I want to put conditions on the operators that can tell the difference. And I can do that by putting in three axioms in my definition of my system that are very natural. So I'll kind of quickly go through them. Is what you would assume you would do. So it's not really that complicated. So if here I have this set xi that is a complete past of y, then there is a completely positive map from y to xi such that if I pick an element x in xi, then the completely positive map from y to x is the reduction of the big map to the algebra of observables on x, which is presumably a subalgebra of the observables on xi. Right? The second thing is that you should have commutativity of unrelated elements. So if I have y and z that are unrelated, then the images of the maps that go from the corresponding algebras to the complete path should commute. So by the way, one thing I'm doing here, maybe I should have said so, is you can, so you have a completely positive map going forward in time, mapping density matrix to density matrix that corresponds to a backward in time completely positive map taking operators to operators, right? So this is in terms of the operators, but it's the same thing as if you were considering going forward. And the third one is composition. So if I go from, so between these two related elements, I put a new little slice of the universe such that this is a complete future of that and the complete past of this, then going, doing the in-between steps should be the same as doing the overall, right? The straightforward composition. So none of these are particularly strange. And what you can show is that if you do that, even if you just start with, what I basically have is a bunch of algebras, finite dimensional matrix algebras, and an assignment of completely positive marks that are supposed to respect exactly what the graph is showing. If you do that, then you will never have to worry about where your unitary maps are. You would get them in the right places. So every time you have indeed the setup where the arrows show that no information was lost from the in to the out, then there's a unitary map there. And similarly, not every choice of unitary maps can be admitted. You would only get the choice of unitary maps that gives you corresponds to the right graph.
No, didn't follow that. Did anybody follow that? Is that supposed to be the summary of the theorem?
Yeah. You want to go through the theorem?
I don't know. That would help. But I'm just being honest and telling you I didn't follow.
Okay, so it wasn't really that deep. What it says is, so you give me this setup. Right? So each one of them is an algebra. And each arrow is a CP map such that the conditions I had before are imposed. That means that, although that's not very good, let me just make it a little more interesting, like this. That means that if I go into the system and I try to find a situation where I would expect to have a unitary evolution, such as, in this case, this would be an example. So if you look at this, what it has is that, right? So what this says, everything that left from here reached there, everything that reached there left from here. So what my conditions say is that these two phis between these algebras is the same as a unitary between the corresponding algebras, right? So if your system, like the case of the expanding universe, is such that you do not have a big overall complete pair, I call it, where you everything that goes in goes out, then you just have a big overall CP map. If you end up, if your causal set combines to a setup of everything goes in goes out, then you have a big U.
That's the big U you need.
Then you go from there again.
Wait, so then this does rule out evolution from pure to mixed states, because U is unitary.
What did you mean then by pure to mixed states? What I had in mind is that you can start with a pure here, and then you get a mixed there.
Sure.
Right?
Well, I just meant, let's say.
Oh, you meant going from a pure here to a mixed there.
Right.
Yeah, that's not. Right.
So it does build in a discrete network form of the unitarity of local quantum field theory. That's really what
yes.
I was getting at.
So in fact, you can think of it as far as I can tell. That was not my origin.
Can we ask you though, why?
Yes.
What was it? It didn't look necessarily that your axioms were going to force this to be true.
You do get that.
So what is it, can you sort of say, what is it about the axiom that forces by to be unitary in this case?
Well, really, you're putting my condition is that you want unitarity when the information is preserved. And my actions reinforce that. You have commutativity when there should be there. You have the fact that if you reduce to a part of the system, you get the right operators, and so on. So that's what the actions are doing. But maybe we can talk about that afterwards, how does it come down. Just to say, the other part of what I was saying is that if you, not every U would correspond to that particular configuration. A different U would correspond to, I don't know, this is not good because it only has one in and one out, but what I'm saying is that there is a relation between the U's and the causal structure that you have underlined. Anyhow, so this you can think of as a discrete version of a quantum field theory in a fairly straightforward way. So for example, in algebraic quantum field theory, what you normally have is causal nets of algebras of local observables. So what you do there is that you take causally complete regions, of course it's quantum field theory, of fixed continuous spacetime, and they go into von Neumann algebras. So you do something very analogous here. You make a discrete version of that. So instead of causally complete regions of continuous spacetimes, you take the elements of my causal set, and you take them to matrix algebras. So then, so you can use that, I guess we just already been through there, that an expanding universe might look like this, and there isn't anything particularly strange about that. People use CP maps all the time. A notion of probability works for it. They're trace-preserving maps. So what I want to say is that the quantum theory works in that setup. It's not as if you don't know what it is that you're talking about. Now,
wait, one sec. And if the dimension of H1 tensor H2 is less than the dimension of all the ones at the top?
Of course. A CP map can't change dimensions.
But doesn't your theorem imply in this situation that there's a unitary map from there's a unitary map from the bottom to the
yes,
top layer?
In this particular case.
But then doesn't
it's a bad picture, I guess.
So, but then doesn't that imply that the dimension of the total Hilbert space
you're right.
cannot grow?
Yeah. So in that case it would. So, but that's a problem of my picture. So so I chose here, I'll tell you what the problem is. So it is a bad picture. So this is a particular type of causal set that actually has a preferred slicing. And that would be the case for that causal set. If you choose a different one, like I had this,
okay. Then
I would have a unitary map between these two, but not between these.
But if I took all the ones on the
bottom. Yes, there would be a whole thing from the end to the end, yes.
Oh, wait, I see those. So you could allow that point which you drew at the bottom, the new one that you added, we need not think of that as occurring at the same time.
Right.
It just sort of popped into existence
right.
and fed into the network.
Yeah, and in the generic causal set has these type of things, right? So the generic causal set, I think that that's one of the things that it proves. You can have squillion of points, and there's only three slices in general. So the configuration of actually having slices is a very rare one for these objects. So it's kind of, somehow, when I draw it, I always draw one that is sliceable, but that is not generally the case.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my statement is that if your causal structure reduces to something that's sliceable, then you'll get unitary as you want, but if not, then you're not restricted to that. Okay, so just to say, the reason that I do something else with those objects, not a field theory of them, because of course I work in quantum gravity and I'm not supposed to do things on fixed backgrounds. So what I really think about the question of whether there is a problem or not is this. So the statement, I'm taking this from Randall this morning, is that if there is a cutoff in the degrees of freedom of the universe, then as the universe expands, then the degrees of freedom or the modes must increase, and that is a problem. So what is going on here is, of course, that you assume that the fundamental degrees of freedom that the cutoff refers to are those of spatial geometry. So if you do quantum gravity, then of course you think that spatial geometry or geometry is an effective concept. So the whole problem that is stated there as far as I can tell, belongs to the semi-classical approximation, and so it's not a fundamental problem. If you have a fundamental theory, that is not really a problem. And I can discuss this quite a bit. I think Olaf is making basically the same point in the next thing. So I'll stop here.
So, Olaf, are you using also that?
Yes.
Okay.
Sergio, you mean by ask one question?
Sure.
So, if you have, if you have a space, if what you're describing is, to very good approximation, a rapidly expanding space, and something close to the city, how can you tell from the structure? If you didn't know beforehand that this is something that is really explosive to the...
If you just leave me and go to I don't know, which is why I don't think it's...
It must be encoded somewhere.
So your question is, if I give you a cause of set, how did you read off the classical space time it corresponds to? I think this is kind of... Let's say I would not spend a lot of time trying to extract that. There is another way of going about these questions that I could discuss, but I don't know that there is any good way of reading that on.
My turn? All right. So now for something completely different. I guess there was a hope that by bunching us all together, there would be sort of a continuity and everybody would say something that complements what the other one says, but I think it couldn't be more different what we're all saying. So, I don't know.
It's just a puzzle set. That's okay.
I guess you have to live with that. So this is very different from, maybe not the spirit, but the details are a bit different from what came before. So I want to say something about background independence and the cosmological constant problem, because I think that if you have some particular understanding of background independence that I will outline in this first part here, then you can very easily say that maybe the cosmological constant problem as we perceive it is rooted in a conceptual problem that we put in the beginning. So I want to say how that comes about. Okay, so I'm going to say something about what I mean by background independence. Then I'm going to say how we get the cosmological constant problem, and then I will say something about this new look that I'm proposing, and then a short outline. So let me start with a view of what is called the whole argument, or the whole problem that Einstein came up with and that troubled him a lot. So the basic argument goes like this, or the basic problem goes like this. Imagine you have a manifold, and say you were to give sort of initial conditions here, some spatial slice, and you want to evolve sort of that manifold to the future. Then what you can do is, since it's a diffeomorphism invariant theory, you can make a diffeomorphism in, say, some compact region here, the dual with these arrows. And what bothered people was that how can the theory then have some predictive power if it can take any pointer, it can move it anywhere else? So what could possibly be the meaning of the metric at one point? And that was very confusing in the early days of GR. And the solution, the way we think about it today, is like this. So we say that instead of thinking of points as just elements of the manifold, we think of them as being defined by matter. So just think of two particles whose world lines I drew here, and then this point here at the intersection is uniquely defined by that intersection of these two particles. And if I do this, this diffeomorphism that I drew in the previous page, then that doesn't really matter. This point is still the point where these two particles meet. It's still this point. That's the only point that's sort of physically, that's the only thing that's physically relevant, is the fact that at this point, these two lines intersect. So that I want to take that as my meaning for background independence. So there's no other meaning for points other than what happens at that point? That's the meaning I want to use. Okay, good. So how can I possibly such a general statement have any sort of relevant consequences? So let's go through how we think about the cosmological constant problem, and that is sort of, I mean, I'm just giving sort of the roughest sketch, which most of you are familiar with it anyway, so let's see. So the way the cosmological constant problem comes about is if we think of quantum field as living on space-time, and then every mode, which I drew by these sort of little harmonic oscillator potential, every mode contributes a little h bar omega to the vacuum energy, and if you sum them all up, you should get a contribution which looks like this. And if you put in the Planck length, for example, here, you get something which is 123 orders off. If you put some supersymmetry breaking scale in there, then you get still something which is way too large, 60 orders of magnitude. So you have a real problem there. This is sort of a real problem. This is. The point to keep in mind here is this. It's the setup problem. Is that you think of matter as sitting on space-time. So it's the vacuum oscillations of matter that curve the space-time, and the curvature that you calculate is far too big. So now let's combine the two things that I just said. The view of background independence and this. Thing. So the origin of the problem is that we think of matter as living on space. So this, if you think about it, what I said before, this is plainly not background independent. It's not a background independent way of thinking of the problem. It's that we think of matter as living on space time. But it's if you think about what I said about background independence before, it is that the space time doesn't exist other than the points that are defined by the matter. So you're making sort of a mistake here. You're making a fundamental mistake. And you could say that the cosmological constant problem arises because you're looking at the problem in an insufficiently background independent manner. Okay, good. So that was the point that I wanted to make. So I'm being sort of now what I should do is I should give you a model where you could sort of clearly analyze that. But since I was told that I only have like 10 minutes or something, I skipped that. So I'm just going to say something about where one can take this. So the point of this is now, of course, you have to write down a model where you can see how space-time arises from that. And then you have to see how curvature arises and these are sort of things in development. Another thing which you might want to think about is why is lambda so from this argument that I just gave, lambda should be zero.
Excuse me. It's assumed there in the element at all that the target value that when rho matter is equal to zero, that rho lambda is equal to zero. So the solution is being assumed.
Sorry, where?
In the
process. Oh, in that thing. Yeah. That's right. But that's not what But that's not my argument. That's their argument.
They assume.
No. This I cite because I want to use their argument to say why lambda it has the value it has.
But if you're not going.
But there were, so if you want the
tells from there.
No, they assume they assume that the
they say that when rho m is equal to zero, that rho lambda goes to zero at the same time.
Yes, but that's there. Why? Yes, that's true in their paper.
Yeah, so you're not solving the calculus,
but
you're assuming.
No, they don't solve it. I do. This is not me. This is not what I just said. It's not contained in that paper.
Okay.
Okay, good. So, I mean, the point is that from the argument that I gave before, you would get lambda equal to zero. This is not what you observe. So you want to come up with an argument why does has the value it has? And one could think that Raphael sort of touched on that before, and one could sort of apply, I hadn't worked this out, but one could apply this the same sort of reasoning in this thing, only you have to replace this square root of n uncertainty by an uncertainty that comes from the fact that the system I'm looking at is a quantum system. So definitions of length scales and time scales are naturally these quantum uncertainties. And then sort of this point that I think Routini just made already. So the size of the Hilbert space and the size of and geometry, they are not directly related. So the geometry comes from the excitations that you have in your system. And those are the ones that you have them, and they don't have to grow for the size of the Hilbert space doesn't have to grow for the universe to grow. That just doesn't follow. So in this case, it's sort of this thing really does, this question as you just posed here really doesn't show up. So that problem can also be seen as sort of an artifact of using a quantum field theory on the space. There, then really you have this problem, because if you make the spacetime bigger, you should make the quantum field theory bigger, right? But that is sort of, it's an artifact of the way you look at that. All right, that was it. Thanks.
I suppose we have a little bit of time. We should keep in mind that we want to have a little bit of a break before the next talk at 6. What? So, maybe I think we're going to break. So, as far as the workshop is concerned, this is it for today. Tomorrow morning, there's another talk at 6. Let's thank all the speakers.